experiment, test of the principal equivalence, test of the inverse square law at short distances, and test of cosmic preferred frames. And I'll discuss why we're doing them, some of the methods, and of course the results. I don't have time to talk about another test that is being done, laser ranging to the moon with millimeter precision on the shape of the moon's orbit that is led by Tom Murphy at University of California, San Diego, as a collaboration between San Diego, University of Washington, Harvard, and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. The experiments I will have time to talk about were done by the EdWatch group at the University of Washington, and the people involved are here, and they, what they're primarily working on are color-coded.
My battery must be.
There's this copy of
this. In the front.
And what they're primarily working on, all the people involved with everything are listed in the color code right here. As I don't need to point out that in this group, identifying gravity with the rest of physics is really a central problem in fundamental science. And right now, the only framework that makes this implication in a very inherent way is Stringer M theory, but it has a lot of features that, as Lee Smolin points out, one has to hide experiment. For example, the 10 or 11 dimensions, the hundreds of massless scalar particles that are an inherent part of string theory, and there's no direct evidence for any of this. And in addition, we have the problems of having to account for the extreme weakness of gravity and the observed dark energy. And it's an interesting thing that there are suggestions that some of these new features could show up as tiny effects in test of the equivalence principle or the inverse square law. Now, the equivalence principle tests have a very long history. It is alleged that Galileo dropped balls from the leaning tower of Pisa, but actually he was smarter. He rolled them down inclined planes, so times were longer. And the test of the principle of equivalence then is our default time for different objects equal. Newton did the test shown right here, where he had pendulums made of two different materials, and he tried to see if their periods were obeyed the simple law, where it was assumed that the inertial and gravitational mass were the same, because Newton was bothered by the fact that he was using mass in two different senses. He recognized it, and he tested it. Bessel improved the test to the level of 10 minus 4, but by far the most sensitive test to date work on the Edwish principle, which is kind of subtle. And so let me just briefly tell you how it works. If you were to hang a pendulum from the surface of the rotating Earth, it wouldn't point straight down to the center of the Earth, because in addition to the gravitational force acting on the pendulum, there is the inertial force due to the rotation of the Earth. And as a result, the pendulum, in this simple idealized case, would hang in the northern hemisphere, would hang a bit to the south, and that angle epsilon at our latitudes is about a tenth of a degree. And the Edwish test consists basically of asking, is this angle epsilon equal for different materials? And it's now done to a couple of parts in 10 to the 13th, and it's not obvious how you do that, so let me just explain. You don't do it, of course, by hanging first one pendulum then the other. What you do is you hang the two pendulums from a bar, and if we assume that the inertial to gravitational mass ratio of the red object is greater than it is to the blue object, the red object is going to go more towards the equator than the blue object, and what that will do is cause this bar to twist. Now, the absolute twist angle of that bar is, of course, a meaningless thing. But what is a meaningful thing is to rotate the instrument about the axis of this fiber here, which will define the average down sense of it. And if you do that, then the blue object is still thrown less to the equator than the red object. and that will cause the bar to twist in the opposite direction. And that's the principle of the experiment. And the important point to realize is that this bar will only twist if the force vectors are not parallel. So that's why it works. You can't possibly make the masses equal to Q bars in 10 to the 13th. You can't possibly make these lever arms the same, but in the end it doesn't matter, because what you're really doing is you're looking for the non-parallelism of these forces. So that's the basic principle. If the equivalence principle is violated, of course, down is not a unique direction. So down for a blue object is different from down for a red object. But also, if the gravity field isn't perfectly flat here, these two objects, as you twist them, will be at different points in the gravity field, and you will see tidal forces that will look like a violation principle equivalence, but has nothing to do with it. It's simply that your laboratory is not local enough, it's not tiny enough. Okay? And in fact, that is the fundamental limitation. All this stuff got the modern generation of experiments got started when Ephraim Fishbach went back and looked at the classic data of Lepersch and claimed that there was some correlation between the number of baryons per gram that were in various test bodies that Lepersch used, like snakewood and platinum and so on. And he claimed there was such a correlation. That correlation was evidence for a new interaction that in addition to the gravitational interaction, you got a force that was coupling to baryon. And that's what got us and interested in testing the equivalence principle. We didn't feel it made sense to go back and look at the ancient records in Budapest, but that much would rather to do an experiment. What Fishbach really did was cause everyone now to think about these equivalence principle tests in rather a different way. We can look at it two ways. We can say, is inertial and gravitational mass exactly the same thing, which is, in a sense, the foundation of general relativity. Or we could say, let's assume that the equivalence principle is exact for gravity, and we'll use this as a way to test for any new quantum exchange forces that are operating between particles. And here's a way to get rid of the gravitational background. In other words, to look for things weaker than gravity. And that's a very interesting thing, because Model and others have pointed out that, well, I say Model and collaborators, that if you found a new long-range, very, very weak force, that is something that absolutely cannot be accommodated in shrinking. So the idea is, if you have a general exchange interaction between fermions, we can write the static potential in this form, where there is the quote charge that the interaction couples to, the product of those charges, and then there's going to be some Yukawa factor. The acceleration of a body is the force divided by its mass, and that's proportional to the charge to mass ratio of the test body. And it turns out that this cannot be exactly equal for all objects. It's very easy to see that that must be true for any vector interaction, because vector interactions it's easy to understand, because they're like electromagnetism that we all do understand. The charge to mass ratio of an electron is the negative of the charge to mass ratio of a positron, and is minus 2,000 times the charge to mass ratio of a proton. And so objects made of electrons, protons, and so on can have the same, exactly the same charge to mass ratio. And the argument for this is a scalar interaction is more complicated, but in the end, it's also true. And the interesting thing is that many of the ideas for extending the standard model involve new quantum mechanical exchange interactions. And of those, many predict very low mass exchange particles. And therefore, we have a direct way to test it. This shows the pendulum that we're currently using to test the principle of equivalence. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 behind test bodies. There are 4 of one kind and 4 of the other. The test bodies have this sort of barrel shape so that their mass quadrupole and mass L equals 4 moments vanish. The 4 of these objects are, in this picture, are beryllium, and 4 of them are titanium. Titanium being denser than beryllium, the titanium bodies have cavities inside with the same shape, so that on the outside everything looks the same. That's very deliberate. The principle we used here is to try to make it impossible by any trivial means to tell which kind of test bodies you have in various places. Everything's coated with gold for electrostatic reasons. And this thing sits on the turntable, very high quality turntable, that rotates very uniformly about the vertical axis. And then we pick up any twist in this object by shining a light beam off of any one of the 4 mirrors that are shown right here. The suspension fiber is so fine it doesn't show up in this picture. And the reason for having 4 test bodies like this is I mentioned that tidal forces, variations in the gravity field, are the limiting factor in this experiment. And so what we're trying to do is make this, in some sense, look like a sphere. And this particular arrangement has a vanishing L equals 2, L equals 4 moments, and all the odd moments vanish by symmetry, commonly. Okay, so it's very insensitive to its orientation in the gravitational field. And likewise, these test bodies have the same kind of symmetry, and they sit in these kind of rocket cone holders, and that's designed so that if they're not exactly centered in that thing, rotate a little bit, the center mass doesn't move. So a lot of attention has been paid to the problem of gravity gradients. Sits on a very high quality turntable. We think it's the highest quality rotation platform that's been made. And I don't have time to go through this. Let me just point out one feature. It's very important that this turntable, in addition to rotating very uniformly, also rotate about the average down. In other words, about the direction of that suspension fiber. Because there are systematic effects that happen if you rotate something about an axis which isn't exactly down, some subtle dirt effect. And the laboratory floor is constantly moving around as the sun comes up and down, there are pressure changes, blah, blah, blah. And so we have to keep this thing truly vertical. And we do that by having 3 feet that this rests on. And we can control the temperature of the bottom part of these feet. And that allows them to expand and contract by microns to take out the variation of the laboratory floor. This shows what a rotating tilt sensor sees on the instrument. Part of this is the imperfections in the bearing. This is an older bearing than the one you see right here. But then there's a slow change in this pattern is the laboratory floor. Okay? And the feedback system, the feedback system they call it, works very well. If you turn it on, the picture looks like this. And so basically you turn that into that. So it works really very well. The problem with gravity gradients is actually a very serious one. The first thing you have to do is measure the gravity gradients. And we're now doing it with this funny shaped thing, which has 4 trays with places where you can put little spheres. And depending on how you put the spheres on this little tray, it's sensitive to various multiple components of the gravity gradients. So you put them in here. This measures the leading term of the gradient with the spheres that way. And this measures some higher term in the gradient. And so once you've measured the gradient, you can calculate what kind of distributions of matter you have to put up in order to cancel that component of the gradient. So that's what we do. We measure the Q21 with that first thing I showed you. Then you put up this 800 kilograms of carefully machined lead. And you tweak it so that you get rid of that moment. Then you put up smaller things and steadily smaller little distributions of matter cancel the higher components of the gradient. That works only so well because, in fact, the gradient changes with time. Okay. This is a picture taken in early November of 1994 when we first discovered the problem. This shows the gradient as a function of time that was taken after we completed the series of measurements, and he started out small as we expected, but then each one of these points took about 4 hours, and you see the gradient was steadily changing. Those of you that are familiar with the Pacific Northwest, early November is when the rains start, and what happened was, as USU found the graduate student from the thesis work, it was explained by the water soaking into the ground and some of the buildings. She dug a hole and measured it and so on. So what that means is you can't cancel the gradient in real time. We just don't, the data taking isn't have a high enough bandwidth. So what we have to do is make the pendulum more symmetrical. And so what we do is we reverse the gradient compensator. So instead of canceling the fields, gradient fields, we amplify them by a factor of 2. And then there are little tiny screws that we can tweak on the pendulum to tweak out the little moments. Because I said the moments were 0. Of course, they're not 0. They were designed to be 0 within the precision of the manufacturing, but nothing's perfect. And so we solved that problem by a little tweaking arrangement. A problem we just found out about this year is the problem of Dow. So here is the turntable of that new instrument. The torsion pendulum hangs from it, and we have a rotating level sensor up here on the axis, and we feed back so that this doesn't see any tilt. But in fact, what you really care about is where is down here. You don't care about where down is there, you care about where down is here. So, and we were correcting to down there. So the turntable turned about down there, not down here. So we have a second sensor, and then we have to interpolate between them. So we find out where down is right there. And that looks, having solved that problem, we were able to get the results that are shown right here. This is for beryllium and titanium test bodies. We're just completing data taken with beryllium and aluminum test bodies, and the article will shortly be sent off. But what you notice is that the acceleration difference of those two materials in centimeters per second squared is, you know, a few times 10 to the minus 13. Okay? And the thing to do, we can watch things falling in the field of the Earth. We can, the computer knows where the sun is at any time. We can watch things falling in the field of the sun, in the field of the galaxy, or in the frame defined by the rest frame defined by the CMB. And the numbers are all very, very similar, but what you have to do to understand what's the power of the test is compare the acceleration difference to the average gravitational acceleration toward that source. In the case of the field of the Earth, where the equivalence principle parameter eta is a couple of parts in 10 to the 13. In the field of the sun, it's about 5 parts in 10 to the 13. Watching things fall toward the center of the galaxy, our acceleration toward the center of the galaxy, of course, is much lower than it is toward the sun. So the test here is 1.5 parts in 10 to the 5th, and I will tell you why that's interesting. And in the field of the CMB, we take our current velocity of the solar system with respect to the CMB and divide it by the Hubble time, and that's 1.5 parts per thousand.
I have a question.
Yeah. So
how can you decompose an acceleration to one in 3 sources? So somehow.
Okay, let me explain it. Of course, there are only 3 in the space directions. We only sense 2 of them in the laboratory, if you see the horizontal plane. But, you know, the Earth is rotating around, and so, in fact, we are able to explore accelerations and differences in 3 directions. And we can see, are there some that track the orientation of the sun, in other words, that would that behave as if there were acceleration differences toward the sun and toward the sun and the galaxy and so on.
It's basically astronomy at many different times.
Right. It's looking at the time history of acceleration. It's the same data, but just analyzed. Okay. And some of the, what we can do now with these, they were null results. Okay. What we can do is test various hypotheses. We can say, suppose there were an interaction that coupled to the number of baryons. Okay? For instance, that would make antiprotons fall with different acceleration than protons. And the constraints are shown here. Their ruled out areas are shaded. And what's plotted is the absolute value of this strength parameter alpha, which is a dimensionless number, versus the range lambda of the Yukawa interaction, which is inversely proportional to the mass of the same particle. And what you see is that for very low masses, the masses are listed up here, the tests are, at the level of a coupling with respect to gravity of 10 to the minus 9 or so. The famous Dickey test done at Princeton watching things fall towards the sun is shown right there. You see that these results are very sensitive. There's a region here where we're currently not quoting results, and that's simply because it's very hard to figure out what is the direction and magnitude of the Yukawa interaction in the case where the length scale is long compared to the local topography, but short compared to the size of the whole Earth. And that's simply because on scales bigger than this, you can think of the Earth, a very good approximation, as a fluid under the combined gravitational and rotational forces. And for distances short compared to 10 kilometers, there's enough known about the local topography that you can calculate. In between, it's complicated. We've got a big lake and mountains behind that, but the mountains stick up because they're floating. They're at lower density, and so, it gets complicated.
Yes.
Yes.
Where is the
Fischbach thing? Oh, I didn't even show that. That was a claimed positive result, which would have been 10 to the minus 2 and the range of about here. Okay.
And also, does the exclusion plots extend to the far right?
The exclusion plots based on the equivalence principle extend off to infinity. This one that comes from lunar laser ranging is a test of the inverse square law, and that falls off for distances big compared to the size.
So that means you're thinking about to apply to, say, rotation curves in the galaxy?
These apply all the way up. Okay? The equivalence principle tests go out. The inverse square law tests are only good in a restricted range of.
What do you mean by all the way up?
Just what I said.
Well, how far?
I guess the thing I don't understand is you're not probing those distances, right?
If the force had an infinite range, it also operates on finite distances, right? So.
So this is for a particular form of the correction where the base of the Yukawa mass is
The way we analyze it is assume it's the Yukawa. But the point is we're saying it's a force that violates the principle of equivalence. And therefore, even if it has an infinite range, it still affects things that are closer. And we test it so carefully at the distances involved that we said these limits. It's different from the inverse parallel. The inverse square law tests all look like this. There's a region where they're sensitive and that's it. It's important to understand that difference, I'm very glad we do that. And a particularly interesting quantum number may be baryon number minus that quantum number, because that's a conserved quantity in lots of grand unified theories. And here are the constraints here. I want to talk about one interesting application of the results of watching things fall towards the center of the galaxy. And that is.
So, sorry, what did that thought have to do with baryon minus Lepton number?
It is what we assumed to be the charge. In this case, we assumed the charge was baryon number minus Lepton. Okay. We can actually provide a laboratory answer to a question which ought to be interesting to people. Namely, is it really true that gravity is the only long-range force between dark and luminous matter? Of course, that's what the sensible people assume when we're trying to understand cosmology and dark matter, etc. But it would be nice to know that that were really true, since we don't exactly for sure know what the dark matter is. And you can do a laboratory test. And let me describe it to you. So here's a kiddie cartoon in the view of our galaxy, and there's the University of Washington. It's accelerating towards the center of the galaxy with this very small acceleration listed right there. And although 90% of the mass of the galaxy is thought to be, this is a proxy, of course, dark matter, most of it lies outside the radius of the University of Washington. And so you can expect that of the total acceleration towards the center of the galaxy that we experience, the dark matter accounts for, you know, 25 to 30% or so. This was estimated by Christopher Stubbs. And therefore, that the acceleration towards the center of the galaxy due to the dark matter is this small amount here. And you can make an interesting statement about whether there is some non-gravitational. By that, I mean equivalence principle violating. That's the definition of non-gravitational for us, okay? If you can detect differential accelerations that are 1,000 times or better, smaller than this, and that's simply because if you try a whole bunch of test bodies, it's very hard to imagine that all of them, or none of them, any of them, have an acceleration, a charge difference, which is less than a part per thousand. For instance, you know, the number of electrons per gram, or the number of fermions per gram, or the neutron to proton ratio. All of these are at least several times 10 to the minus 2 differences in test bodies, and then they differ up to 10%. So here we have our two different kind of test bodies. They have the acceleration due to the ordinary matter. We've already tested that very precisely with our ordinary equivalence principle test. And then there's the acceleration due to the dark matter. And what we actually can measure is this, and we want to infer that. And that's done very easily. We assume that any equivalence principle violating interaction is proportional to some charge, generalized charge of the dark matter, and then the differential acceleration is related to the difference in the charge to mass ratio of the test bodies. We make no assumption about that. What we do make an assumption about is the form of the charge of ordinary matter. We say it's proportional to the sum of the charge of electron and proton, because our bodies are electrically neutral, and then also to the number of neutrons. And these parameters, we define the ratio of this to that as a free parameter, and these are our results for the acceleration difference. And we show on the plot here what the constraint is. So what's plotted here is the ratio of non-gravitational acceleration, total acceleration of neutral hydrogen towards the dark matter in our galaxy. And at this point, where this psi is defined here, it's the tangent of the sum of electron-proton charges to the bottom of the neutron charge. At this point, we have there's no non-gravitational acceleration. And that's just a matter of definition. At that point, neutral hydrogen is zero. And you see we combined two different experiments here. And we can say that, you know, at the level of about 2 sigma, at level of about 5% is the most that any non-gravitational component could be of the acceleration of neutral hydrogen towards going to the dark matter. And you know, we think that's an interesting thing to be able to test in the lab.
Is that interaction needed from some other considerations?
No, I'm not saying it's needed. I'm just saying we would like to have a firm experimental foundation.
Sure, yes. No, I'm just curious.
No, I'm not saying it's needed. I'm just saying.
I'd be confused about this issue of violation of the presence of physics, because if the power term is due to a fifth force set, then which has a fifth force charge, then it's not violating the privilege. The res force doesn't violate the privilege. It's only pure gravity. See what I'm saying?
Well, whether you consider it a violation of the equivalence principle or a new force, okay, that's partly a matter of choice. Okay, we're not saying this has to do with gravity, and therefore maybe it has nothing to do with in the theorist view of equivalence principle. We're saying the experimentalist view of equivalence principle is something that gives you an acceleration of electrically neutral test bodies. That is not directly exactly proportional mass. So that's our working definition. I'm not saying this is a. If we see something, we have not established if it's a property of gravity or some new very big force. So it's just an experimentalist definition of what we mean by violation.
So in a strong equivalence principle, you cannot test.
Well, yes. In fact, that's one of the things that's most precisely tested by laser ranging to the moon. Okay? And maybe I could defer the answer to the question. Okay? But we do test that by laser ranging to the moon, complemented by having test bodies which look like, in effect, mini Earth and mini moon as far as their compositions are concerned. No laboratory test of that, so we rule out weak equivalence principle violation with laboratory test bodies that look like the Earth and the Moon, and then the laser ranging tests the sum of the weak and strong equivalence principle, and so therefore you can get out the strong. So that's tested at several parts in 10 to 4, the strong. Yes?
Do you actually detect the center of the galaxy, or? Put another way, do you have to take into account that the galaxy is there when you do your analysis, or do you just?
Oh yeah, no. We know where the center of the galaxy is. The computer knows where it is at any instant, and so as we're analyzing our data, we look for a time behavior that would be characteristic of something falling towards the center of the galaxy.
But that's just the daily effect. Is it degenerate with other daily effects?
Well, it's a sidereal effect.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it. So I'm going to now switch gears, and I'm going to have to go fast because I still have yet another topic I'd like to talk about. This is testing the inverse square law at the shortest practical distances, and the shortest practical distance right now is about 50 microns. And why would you want to do it? Well, first of all, in electromagnetism, we know that the relativistic generalization of Coulomb's law works down to 10 to the minus 16 centimeters from P plus and minus collider data. But for gravity, until a few years ago, we didn't know that it worked at length scales below a centimeter. And of course, the reason is gravity is very weak. And there's a reason that it appeals to me. May not appeal to you, but it probes what I call the dark energy length scale, and I'll tell you what that is in a minute. It looks, it's the bomb-proof signature of large extra dimensions. It tests for an interesting mechanism that Justin Bury has talked about, namely the chameleon mechanism. And that's an interesting thing. It's a way to escape the experimental bounds on low mass scale particles. The string theory is full of low mass scale particles, but if they were around, they should have been seen in tests of equivalence principle and so on. But there are no observed violations, and so people tried to understand, was there some way that you could keep these particles and escape the experimental bounds on this chameleon mechanism was invented as a way to do it. And I'll tell you a little bit more about it in a minute. And there are other suggestions of fat gravitons made by Sundgren and others. And the way we parameterize violation of the inverse square law is, again, an additional Yukawa term. This time it doesn't multiply any charges, it's simply proportional to mass. And the test of the inverse square law, the most precise tests are astronomical. This is laser ranging to the moon. This will get, you know, roughly a factor of 10 better from the new Holiday than once there's enough of it. And then there are laboratory tests that, this is as of 2000, laboratory tests in this regime, and then here they sort of messy kind of geophysical tests that are done. But the region of interest now is down here. And again, this got started thanks to theoretical suggestions by Arkani Hamed, Demopoulos, and Duvalli. We heard a colloquium from NEMA about large depth dimensions, and that got us started testing. Now, what's this business about the dark energy length scale? Well, it's kind of following the spirit of Planckian. It's except to say, maybe there's a second fundamental number associated with gravity in addition to Newton's constant, namely the dark energy density. As far as we know, you know, it's been constant over the lifetime of the universe. Maybe it is a fundamental number, in which case you can form a new length scale using the observed density of dark energy, and that length scale is 85 microns. And really, you know, it's worth testing the gravity works at that length scale. The reason, let me just show you why this is such a bomb-proof test for the idea of a large extra dimension. Let's suppose this is one of our ordinary three space dimensions. And this is one of the curled up dimensions, and we place a point mass down along our x-axis, and then we bring a second point mass along this axis here. And let's furthermore assume that we are confined onto the three ordinary space axes, and only gravity knows about the extra dimensions. That's the scenario. And it's plausible on a string theory basis. Okay? So what do you see? Well, out here, the lines of force have become parallel, because the lines of force behave just like Faraday said. They repel each other, and they don't like to bend, and so on. And so what happens is out here, the lines of force become parallel. The force law would be a constant. But then as you get closer to the point mass, smaller part of this radius, the lines of force now start converging. And so you would see Gauss's law in two dimensions. You see it's one over our force law. And so by testing Gauss's law in this view, what you're doing is you're testing the geometry of space. And it's a completely robust and unambiguous signature. The device we've used, published most recently, consists of a torsion pendulum that looks like this. Now the instrument doesn't rotate at the hole. The only thing that rotates is the attractor sitting right underneath the pendulum. And the active elements in this pendulum are the holes in this ring here. And the active elements in the attractor are the holes in that disk. And the idea of what you're actually studying is the gravitational interaction, in effect, between the missing mass in this set of holes and the missing mass in that set of holes. Okay? And so what you've done is you've arranged to have a signature, in this case, at 21 times the frequency of disturbance. The frequency of disturbance is the frequency with which this attractor rotates underneath. Okay? And the signal is at a definite frequency, 21, exactly 21 times that compared to the components of 42 or 63, and so on. And furthermore, the attractor is actually consists of two pieces that are attached together. The bottom piece has the same angular symmetry, but the holes are exactly halfway in between this set of holes. And they're thicker and bigger diameter, and it's been engineered so that if Newton were right, okay, then the 21 times signal, twist signal on this torsion pendulum is exactly, now due to the upper set of holes here, is exactly canceled by an equal and opposite torque from the lower set of holes. So that's the idea. So you made a null for Newtonian physics. But if there's new short-range physics, this stuff is simply too far away to do any effective cancellation. And so you haven't paid much price for short-range, new short-range physics, but you've substantially canceled Newtonian physics. Okay? Of course, these normally run much closer together, but if I put them at that distance, then you couldn't see anything. And if you just did it this way, you'd measure garbage, and the reason is that electrostatic non-uniformities, which are present even in perfectly pure materials and so on, you would just be measuring electrostatic garbage. So between these two is a very thin 10 micron thick, very tightly stretched conductive foil. This shows a picture of when you've taken off the vacuum vessel and the electrostatic shield surrounding this. You see the pendulum with its 42 holes, and there are the mirrors off which we shine light beams. And up top is a little tray that has three tiny spheres on it. You can't see one of them, one, two, three. And outside this whole system, there are rotated three fist-sized spheres. And we use that for continuous gravitational optical calibration. And this very tightly stretched beryllium copper foil is shown right here. There's the attractor. And I have to run on because of time. This shows what you see if you look at the twist signal from that thing. And what you're seeing here is just the thermal, more or less thermal excitation of the pendulum. It's oscillating at its resonant, pre-resonant period. You can't see the gravitational signal at all. And then we apply a five-point digital filter to this, and it has a notch about pre-resonance period. And you see the gravitational signal. There are 21 peaks here for one rotation of the attractor, which shows one complete rotation of the attractor. And that's, of course, the gravity between the holes. Okay. And that's the first time that anyone could have told you that gravity works at that length scale. And we did a series of three experiments because at the very shortest distances here, less than 60 microns, we kept on seeing some kind of effect, but the effect varied with trivial changes in the apparatus. You know, we changed the degree of cancellation of Newtonian force, we recoded the gold surfaces and so on. We ended up including all the data from all three experiments. What's shown here is the twist as a function of the separation. The signals at 21 times frequency, 42 times frequency. And then the signals, the 21 times signals, if you did away with the bottom attractor or did away with the top attractor. In other words, these show what uncancelled gravity looks like. It's been divided by a factor of 20. So actually, the gravitational signal is way above the floor there. The Newtonian signal exactly cancels only at one particular separation between them, so the signals cross through zero. And the results from this last experiment, we exclude things. Here is the dark energy length scale. Here is something with effectively gravitational strength. So we've checked the inverse square law at this dark energy length scale. We know that it holds down to 56 microns. The largest possible size of an extra dimension is 44 microns. People sometimes think that these experiments are only interestingly sensitive for a restricted number of extra dimensions. But that's not really true, because something has to stabilize the size of these extra dimensions. It's another scalar field called the radion field. And the radion field also would produce a force that you would see in these experiments. It's been calculated that it has a strength related to the number of extra dimensions given by that, and a range that's a couple of millimeters. And that says even if there are six extra dimensions, if you believe these theory papers, the unification mass must be 6.4 GeV or so. I mentioned this very interesting chameleon mechanism. What you do is, if you imagine there's a scalar field, but it has a little nonlinear self-coupling. Okay? That little nonlinear self-coupling actually has a profound effect, and I don't have time to go through it. But what it does is, in effect, give a massless particle in matter an effective mass, so that if this nonlinear coupling exists, then only the outside skin of any test bodies is effective, because the interior parts are shielded. And so what this meant was that all the classic tests of gravity were not as sensitive as you thought, because it was assumed that this weakly coupled scalar interaction, for example, was sourced by the whole test body, but in fact it's only the outside skin that was really active in this picture. And so with this data and the help of Amol Alpaidi at Princeton, we calculated what would be the effect of this chameleon exchange between the attractor and the test body and the pendulum in our experiment. And it's related that there are two elements here, the coupling for matter and the self-coupling gamma. And the natural values for these parameters are what? Because they're normalized to Planck state. And it turns out that the skin depth for our molybdenum test bodies is 60 microns. And so here are our constraints on the coupling to matter and the self-coupling. The natural value is right here, and the area excluded is right there. So this is a first test, really, of this chameleon mechanism. And the sort of the natural value for this is really excluded by the data. You still get interesting effects even if you have much weaker couplings. But nevertheless, this is really the first test of the mechanism. We have two new tests of inverse Gerlach going on right now. One based on the attractor. This is what it looked like coming out of the machine shop. But the spacing here is about 50 microns. And it's 50 microns thick. And another one using parallel plates. We think we're going to get down to a 20 micron length scale with these. I want to quickly end up with the test of cosmic preferred frames. The subject of Lorentz, test of Lorentz invariance is actually there's a mini industry of that now. And it's an interesting thing because it's a way to get Planck scale physics. And Kostolecki and his co-workers have worked out some elaborate scenario where they consider a most general form of Lorentz violating interactions. It used to be thought there was no way really to test CPT invariance because you couldn't write down a field theory that violates CPT. So how do you evaluate the effectiveness of an experimental test? And what Kostolecki et al. Did was they say, well, let's suppose there's a preferred frame that violates the Pauli-Luders theorem. So you can write down a local field theory that violates CPT. Because now we assume that there is a frame fixed in the universe, and Lorentz invariance still works for an observer. In other words, if you turn your head or boost yourself, all the Lorentz invariance applies. But a particle, if you twist a particle, you haven't twisted the universe, and so Lorentz invariance does not apply to the particle. And if you ask how big would you expect some violation effects to be with electrons, you would say, well, it should be roughly the order of ME squared over M prime, and that's 2 times 10 to the minus 17 eV. And one of the observables is simply to ask, does an electron spin prefer to rotate about some direction fixed in inertial space? Okay, is there some preferred direction that a spin would feel? And so to test that, we developed a pendulum that has 10 to the 23rd polarized electrons in it. Another thing we found out about only quite recently was that it's also a very sensitive test of the idea of non-commutative spacetimes. The idea is here there are some string theory reasons to think that maybe at some very fine scale, the space-time coordinates do not commute, but rather they have this form here. And this theta has units of area. And in analogy to the way we think about the ordinary Heisenberg uncertainty principle, this looks sort of like it, right? This theta represents the minimum physical area that makes any sense. I mean, just like the Heisenberg principle says that the minimum probability of P of delta x that makes any sense. Okay? And if this if there is such a non-commutative nature of the space-time, then it turns out it makes an effective sort of pseudo-magnetic field. And the simple way to see how that might be is suppose we go from A to B in two ways, delta x, delta y, or delta, delta y, delta x, or delta x, delta y. But those aren't equal, and so there's some net circulation, and the spin that's perpendicular to this will be able to sense this. Okay. And the effective interaction for an electron spin is shown right here, where lambda is some cutoff that people assume to be a TeV. The nice thing about testing this with electrons is that they really are point particles. If you test them with neutrons or protons, so it's you're not dealing with point particles. So this is a very direct test of this idea. And the way the spin pendulum works is kind of cute. It would be easy to get a whole lot of polarized electrons in something, but the trouble is each one of these electrons is a little magnetic dipole, and you would develop yourself a very expensive magnetic compass. And so what you have to do is find a way to get a whole lot of spins with a completely negligible external magnetic field. And the way we do that is by combining two different kinds of magnetic materials, an ordinary ferromagnet and a samarium cobalt magnet. And the samarium cobalt is interesting material because the samarium has a big spin. Hund's rule will tell you there's five halves spin per samarium ion. Okay? But it has a very tiny magnetic moment. And the reason is that there is an L equals 5 in this thing, according to Hund's rule. The G factor is 2, and so those two things, according to Hund's rule, are opposite. And so the orbital angular momentum of the samarium ion is almost exactly canceled the spin component of the magnetic moment. And so what you can do is you can arrange this thing so that in principle all the magnetic flux stays inside this what we call a puck, this kind of octagonal toroid. But in the case of the samarium, there's because of the cancellation of the samarium's magnetic moment, but not its spin, you have a lower spin density than you have in the iron magnet. And so then in this case, there will be a net spin pointed in the direction of this hockey stick. And if you make four of these pucks and you orient and shown some of the magnetic fields that run in the direction of the arrows, the spin vectors in each of these pucks line up. We have equal amounts of the two materials on the two sides, so we're not sensitive to ordinary equivalence principle violating effects. And the center of the spin density is right in the center of the tension. And turns out that this thing has 10 to the 23rd spins in it. It sits in a rotating torsion balance that was used in the very first experiment we ever did that's been substantially upgraded. And this shows you a little photograph. It's about that big, a few centimeters. It shows you these octagonal pucks, as we call them, sitting inside half a magnetic shield. The magnetic shield is just there to get rid of a small amount of stray flux that leaks out because you can't manufacture these things absolutely perfectly. There are little chips on the corners and so on. And here we're measuring the field that leaks out. And the field inside is 9.6 kilogauss, and the field outside is a few milligauss right outside the shield. And what we do now is we look for a twist of the pendulum that would behave as if there was a preferred direction in inertial space. In other words, is it trying to precess around some pseudo B field that's fixed in the And if there were such an effect, it would produce outer phase signals in the north and east directions. For instance, this is what you would have seen if there was something you know, with a strength 2.5 times 10 to the minus 20 eV. I'll remind you that this benchmark value of plant mass, electron mass square of the plant mass is 10 to the minus 17. And this is just 113 hours of data. We took data over 36 months, so we have a lot of data. And we also look for something, you know, as the Earth turns around and then orbits the Sun, and we're only able to sense things in the local horizontal, if for some reason the preferred axis in space just happened to line up with the Earth's spin axis, it wouldn't be modulated as the Earth turns around. Okay? That would look like a signal fix in the lab. And so we measured that, and we found there was a signal fixed in the lab. It happened to point exactly due south. So this is the north, the east component, and this is the north component. So this is pointing due south. And Stefan Schlemmer, a postdoc working on a different experiment, came up with the explanation. We were seeing the what we call a gyrocompass effect, namely the Coriolis effect of the Earth's rotation on the electron spins. So this pendulum, you know, just a chunk of matter sitting on the table, has actually got a lot of angular momentum at the scales that we can measure. And so we were seeing that effect. In fact, this allows us to calibrate the number of spins in the pendulum. The number we predicted to be in there, taking the best available data from neutron scattering experiments and photon scattering experiments with that, in fact, so we measured the magnetic properties of Sumerian cobalt much better than the solid state physicists managed to do. And we found an upper limit in the units of 10 to the minus 22 eV on the energy required to flip an electron about these arbitrary axes fixed in space. Z is the lined up with the Earth rotation axes, and these are perpendicular axes. This error bar is bigger because that's the one that's determined from a laboratory fixed signal. It's more systematic. And these are determined from the signals modulated this area. Here. It's sort of amusing to say, how small is this number? Well, one way to appreciate it is it's numerically equal to the electrostatic energy of two electrons separated by 90 astronomical units. So it's a very sensitive number. What can you do with it? Well, one thing we can do is we can say, suppose there was some long-range CP violating interaction. What kind of constraints can we put on it? And the results from this experiment are shown here. These are the best results from atomic clocks and so on. So they're very highly constraining on long-range CP violating interaction. The effect on non-putative geometries is interesting. This minimum observable patch of area is 6 times 10 to minus 58 square meters. It seems very small. But in another sense, it's also still large. It's roughly 10 to the 6th Planck line square. Okay? It's roughly 10 to the 3rd Grand Unification line square. Okay? But that's still pretty interesting. I mean, think about it. We're doing a little laboratory experiment and we're 10 to the 13th jet. That's way beyond the reach of any accelerator that people imagine. And it's all done with a little chunk of material, you know, considerably smaller than my fist. We're now studying interactions between the spin pendulum and spin sources that are based on the same principles, but they're larger. And the reason for that is Nemec, Khani Hamed, and his collaborators have developed a theoretically consistent modification of infrared modification of gravity they call the Gauss quantum state that, in principle, has the properties of dark energy, for example. And it's kind of like an ether, but the ether is a real scalar field that can be excited and so on, so it's not like an ether, but it's a little bit like it. And that leads to new spin-spin forces. And so that's one reason. And it's also, we can test for its these proposed torsion fields that some gravitational people talk about. These are fields that for their source by intrinsic spin. So thanks very much for allowing me to go through a lot of stuff very rapidly. Here are some references. There's going to be, there's a new paper about the pieces that are here, and they are on work that I'm reading.
Your parameter of the non-commutativity is the same, I think, if I was incorrectly, that was also measured through violations of the land sheet, right? How then does that compare to the upper limit theory by the absence in the land sheet?
I don't know, but I would be willing to bet it's, this is a non-reflector figure. But I don't know the answer. But, you know, you compare it to... you know, all these atomic clock experiments, it's much. Yeah, but see, lamb shift is basically electromagnetic, okay? I mean, that's the scale to start with. Whereas we're subgravitational. Yes?
Question. If normally, in the proper specific test, you're checking the standard Mercalli force expression. For example, the latest part is by Fresh Factor, that is the standard. We plot alpha versus lambda, and a big excursion goes like that. The excursion stops at around 100 AU. So,
but those are based on the equivalence, I mean the inverse square law.
Okay, because I think the future factor plot with A, you said, are you saying the equivalence principle is checked at the galaxy sizes?
I'm saying it's checked all the way out to infinity. Because think of electromagnetism. Suppose somebody told you there was a new force called electromagnetism that had an infinite range. Would you have to do an infinite range experiment to test it? No. You can just do a Coulomb test. You can say there was or there was not such a thing. In other words, if somebody tells you there is an infinite range force that has a certain property, okay, can you test it by doing an experiment to a confined length scale? And the answer is absolutely.
No, but the, and you know, your power force is not infinite range, it's got a range. Right?
It doesn't matter. What you can test, if it has a range short compared to your, you know, very short compared to your separation of your bodies, then it's invisible to you. But if it's got an infinite range, it's entirely visible.
Okay, so you're excluding the infinite range forces.
We're excluding from infinity on down to where that plot.
Maybe a couple less questions, Martin.
What do you think is the ultimate limit of the sort of smallest distance at which one will be able to test the inverse square law? Okay. I guess there are atomic Van der Waals forces that one will be able to screen.
Right. So you put your finger on exactly the problem. Okay. What determines the shortest distance at which you can do it is the shortest distance at which you can exclude non-gravitational forces. Okay. And anything that uses conductors is not really an equal potential. For instance, if you took an absolutely pure surface of copper, it consists of little microcrystals. If you took a very high impedance probe and moved it over the surface of the copper, you would find that the potential varies by tens of millivolts in some very complicated way as you move this probe across the surface. And it's simply due to the fact that the work function of the crystal depends off of which crystalline phase you're talking about. And the typical difference in that work function is, you know, tenths of what? Several tenths of volts. And so it's called a patch effect. So any conductor in the presence of another conductor is going to feel some force. Forget Casimiri, just Coulomb. And so to get rid of these forces, to see gravity at very short length scale, its gravity is now very, very weak compared to ordinary gravity because it's a length scale. But these electrostatic properties are surface properties. The gravitational property is a bottom. Okay, so it gets worse and worse as you get smaller and smaller structures. And so that limit puts you, you know, on the tens of microns, 10 microns. You've got to be able to get a shield, electrostatic shield, in between your attractor and your detector. Now, you know, there are people that talk about, you know, lots of exotic things, but it remains to be seen that they're going to work. I'm worried about electrostatics. And so maybe there's a brilliant solution. I haven't found one that convinced me it's going to work. But it's a great question, and I'd love to find a way to be sure of it. Because, of course, you know, it would be nice if the test is down at the, you know, sub-micron scale. And there are people that do, you know, Casimir force experiments and try to subtract the background and all that. But there are no way near gravitational strength. People use ultra-cold neutrons and study their properties. But again, they're testing 10 to the 12th gravity. So when I say testing the inverse Verloc, I mean testing a gravitational strength. You can do interesting tests if there's something 10 to the 10th times gravity. That's, of course, possible. I mean, can you test it at gravitational strength? That's tough, as far as I know.
Obviously, a fascinating talk, but we need to move on to this. Thank you.